Yeah.
We're going to actually be in Exodus chapter 3 as we continue our study on the book of Exodus. But before we go to Exodus chapter 3, I'm just going to read a verse out of Matthew. We don't have to turn there. But Matthew 13:58, it says here, "And he did not many mighty works there because of their unbelief." And it gets into something I talked about actually when I was in Ohio back in June. But I think it lays out for us how God oftentimes operates with people. And I think one of the things that most people have is a mistaken notion about God and what God does and how God interacts with us. I think oftentimes people have a mistaken idea all one way. God dictates something, and therefore, because he's dictated something, everything ends up happening the way he wants it to happen. And what I want to really look at tonight is how oftentimes God's will can be thwarted, and not only thwarted, but he ends up changing what he's going to do because he can't work the way he wants to. Man has the ability to hinder what God wants to do. He has the ability to force God to change things sometimes. And we don't think of it that way. We always think of it the other way. And I want to look at some verses today to say that. And the reason I started in Matthew is we have there a verse that talks about the fact that God can't do the works he wanted to do where he was because they were in unbelief. So their unbelief hindered his ability to work. And we see all kinds of passages like that in Scripture. For instance, in the book of
John. Hey, Bill, before you go on, what was that verse in our chapter and verse in Matthew?
It was Matthew chapter 13 and verse 58.
Okay. Thanks.
No problem. Even the fact in Matthew chapter 13, that's the passage where Jesus begins to talk in parables for the very first time.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells us why he talks in parables, because there are those who hear what he has to say, but they're not really listening and hearing. Their mind is already made up. And because of that, he now has to communicate in a way where the true believers can hear what he has to say, and those that have no desire in it, it's going to be hid from them. But that wasn't his intent originally. His intent was that they would all hear it. In Genesis, for instance, I'll give one really quick example. I'm not going to go there. But there's the example of where Sodom and Gomorrah are just filled with evil. And God comes to Abraham and he says he's going to destroy those cities. And Abraham says, "Well, Lord, what if there's 50 people that believe, or 50 people that are good?" And God says, "Okay, for the sake of the 50, I won't destroy it." And then Abraham stops and thinks about it for a second, and he goes, "Well, what if there's 40? What if there's only 40? God goes, "Well, I won't destroy it for 40. And by the time all said and done, Abraham has God talked down to, well, all he's got to find is 10 people. And we know the story, Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed because there's not even 10 people there. But the point is that God was willing to adjust and to come into alignment with some things that Abraham was asking him. And it wasn't so stagnant. God responded with Abraham, and it was a dialogue. And with that dialogue, they came to a meeting of the mind, so to speak, where something was palpable, that was a mouthful, to both of them. So I want to look here in Exodus chapter 3 at the first time that Moses comes into contact with God. And if somebody could read, well, we're going to read verses 7 through 10 out of Exodus 3. Maybe we could. Yeah, we could read around. Would you want to start, Rick?
Yeah. "And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have
heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows.
And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good land and a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites. This here is right and the Hittites. It's by high right.
Okay, so here we see that God comes to, the reason that God is revealing himself to Moses is he has a plan. And in this plan, he's telling Moses, well, I've heard the cry of my people, right? I've heard their complaints, and with their complaints, I've seen their afflictions, I've seen their sorrow, I see the burden that's been placed upon them by their taskmasters, and I know they're suffering. So I'm going to deliver them or save them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and I'm going to bring them into a new land that's immense, an immense area. He even tells them the areas that that land is in, and then he says that how he's going to release them, that he's going to send Moses to go to Pharaoh so that Moses can bring God's people out of the land of Egypt. Now, it's interesting because how many people, the first impression you think of Moses, how many times is the first thing you think of the Ten Commandments, that movie? Right? But the reality is nothing like that. The reality is that Moses is very reluctant to go. And not only is he reluctant to go, he doesn't want to go. In no way, shape, or form does he want to go. And he begins here a discussion with God where he's going to present five reasons why he should not go. And with each one of those reasons, God's going to adjust some of the things that he said he would do so that it becomes more and more likely then that Moses would respond to him. So the first objection to God's plan is in verse 11. If you'd like to read that, John.
But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?
The phrase here, who am I? Basically, it would be something along this way if I was to put it in modern everyday English. Why would I go? I'm a nobody. I'm insignificant. I'm inadequate for the job you're giving me to do. How many of us have ever felt that way, by the way? We do, don't we?
Sure.
I think oftentimes when we go through life, there's many tasks that we come into that we have to do where we feel overwhelmed with a task and we feel inadequate to do it. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to do that task because we look around and we see other people that might be better qualified in our mind to do the task. So Moses' objection is that I'm inadequate. Who am I to do this? And God gives an answer here in verse 12. And he said, I will be with you, and this is the sign for you that I have sent you. When you bring out the people from Egypt, all of you shall serve Elohim, that's the word for God, on this mountain. So notice here his answer. Well, you're not going to be alone, Moses. I'll be with you. Now, as Christians, how many of us really believe that God's with us in each and every situation? I mean, do we?
No.
Most of us don't. A lot of times we feel like we're alone, don't we? But God has promised he'd be with us, right? Hasn't he indwelt us?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't his spirit in us? Doesn't he say that he would seal us with his Spirit until the day of redemption, and then he defines the day of redemption as the day that we receive a new glorious body, fashioned like unto his glorious body. So the whole idea that he's getting at here is, I'm with you. You're not inadequate because I'm with you.
Look. It's interesting. Here's a man who communicates with God. That God communicates with him, and he has this inferiority complex.
Right.
I mean, he now talks to you, and it's like, wow. Right. That's me. How about that? Exactly. You're talking to him.
Well, I think,
and he says,
I think one of the interesting things that we're going to see is that he really doesn't necessarily have an inferiority complex. It's more along the line of he doesn't want to go, and it's an excuse.
Do you have to put fear into your heart to tell God no?
It would me. but then again, it shows that they understood God better than we do. They understood that they could have a dialogue with God. For instance, think back with Abraham when he discusses things with God and gets into a dialogue with
bartering.
Bartering, right.
Negotiating.
A negotiation. You know, later on, as Moses gets to know God better, literally he's going to have a sharp disagreement with God. And God gives in to Moses and says, okay, Moses, we'll do it your way. And I'll change my mind on what I was going to do. And he uses the word repent, which literally means a change of mind or change of direction. So we oftentimes don't think of God responding that way. We always think of God as my way or the highway. But that's not how God is presented in Scripture. He's presented as a God who's adaptable, who's adjustable, who's willing to work with people and willing to work with us. So Moses here, he has this. Now, he comes up with another objection. Here's the second objection in verse 13. And Moses said to Elohim, or to God, as sure as I go into the sons of Israel and say to them, the Elohim of your fathers has sent me to you, so of a truth they will say to me, what is his name? What should I say to them? Now, I want to talk about this phrase, what is his name, for a second, because this is really an important phrase. There's a footnote here that I have in the Bible I'm looking at, and I want to read it, because it's a little bit lengthy, but kind of bear with it. There has been considerable debate about the name of Yahweh or Jehovah in the Pentateuch, primarily because of the theories that have maintained that the name Yahweh was not known in antiquity. The argument of this whole section nullifies that view. The idea that Elohim's name was revealed only here raises the question of what he was called earlier. The word Elohim is not a name. It's a title, and we translate that as God, right? El Shaddai, which is another title of God, is used only a few times in Genesis. But Israel would not have had a nameless deity, especially since Genesis says that from the very beginning people were making proclamation of the name of Yahweh. We see that in Genesis 4:26, for instance, in Genesis 12:8. It is possible that they did not always need a name, if they were convinced that only he existed and there was no other God or Elohim. But Moses was anticipating that the Israelites, wanting to be sure that Moses came with a message from their God and that some sign could prove it, they would have known his name and they would have known the ways that he had manifested himself. It would do no good for Moses to come up with a new name for God, for that would be like introducing them to a new God. It would in no way authenticate to them Moses' call, only confuse after that, because they would not be expecting a new name. There's also another reason that Moses does this. The second reason is that primitive cultures at that time believed that knowing the deity's name gave them power over the deity and made the deity subservient to them. This is most likely the reason Moses asks for God's name. Now think about that for a second. The way they believed back at that time frame was that if they knew the name of a deity, that the deity would give it to them, and somehow their power became subservient to the person who would have that name.
Well, knowing the person's name, or especially a deity's
it
name,
creates familiarity.
It does, and it removes a layer of mystique.
That's right.
Mystery.
It does. And think of it this way then. So Moses most likely was asking the name because he believed this was a way where he would gain advantage over God. And by having that advantage over God, he wouldn't have to go because now he would be the supreme. He could refuse because he'd have power over God. We have to also understand here, we always get this idea that Moses believed everything about God instantaneously. Nowhere in the scriptures is that idea there. In fact, we have to remember he was a murderer who had fled, who hadn't had contact with God's people, and who really was living in a society, yes, they knew who God was, but it wasn't paramount in their thinking. So there was a lot of misconceptions that he had. And we have to understand that Moses learned to have faith. When God followed through on things he said he would do, Moses began to believe and to trust in the God, and the relationship grew stronger and stronger as Moses went. In the very beginning, it wasn't so. In the very beginning, we could really say that Moses was a doubter. He really didn't have that background to draw from to say, I believe God. In fact, he wanted to get authority over God. So this is what he was trying to do. He wants to ask him what he asks God what his name is. Verse 14 is God's, verse 14 is God's response. And he's going to respond here all the way to verse 22. I want to read verse 14. Well, if somebody could read verse 14, then I want to read verse 14. I want us to hear it from a number of different versions. So verse 14.
God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you.
Can somebody read that out of King James 2?
And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. He said, thus shalt thou say unto the people of Israel, I am has sent me.
Okay. In the Rotherham Study Bible, or the Rotherham Emphasized Bible, he has a different rendering. And the rendering he has is very similar to the one I'm going to read. And it's going to read a lot different. And I think it's a lot more accurate. Follow this one. Then Elohim, or God, spoke to Moses. I shall come to be just as I am coming to be. And he said, thus shall you say to the sons of Israel, I shall come to be sends me to you. Now, in the Hebrew, it would be the words Ehia Asher Ehia, and it literally means I am he who exists, and I am changeable and flexible. I'm not rigid and set in stone is the idea. Follow what it is. I shall come to be just as I am coming to be. In other words, I'm in existence, and I'm coming to be. I'm adaptable is the idea that's being portrayed there. I'm adjustable. I'm not etched in stone. This is something I am because I'm existing, but I'm not rigid is the idea. It's adaptable. It gives the idea that he's changeable as the future is coming into existence. We have this mistaken idea of God that he always is, always was, and always will be, and he never, ever changes in that. We have this idea that God is the same that he was 8 billion years ago. And what he's saying here is, that's not true. I am, right, just as I am coming to be. In other words, I'm revealing myself to you, and as I'm revealing myself to you, I'm changeable, I'm variable. We can adjust things. It's interesting, too, because he gives Moses a name here. He tells him who he is. So I'm not afraid of you having my name, Moses. It's going to allow you and I to have a better dialogue. It's going to allow us to get to know one another. It's going to allow familiarity. He continues. This is where it really begins. He says in verse 15, Elohim, or God, said again to Moses, "Hence do you say to the sons of Israel, Yahweh, Elohim of your fathers, or God of your fathers, Elohim, or God of Abraham, Elohim of Isaac, and Elohim of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name, to the eon, and this my memorial, generation to generation. Go and gather the elders of Israel and say to them, Yahweh, or the Lord, the Elohim, or the God of your fathers, has appeared to me, the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, Visiting I have visited you, and that which is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And they shall listen to your voice, and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to Egypt's sovereign. And all of you shall say to him, Yahweh Elohim, or the Lord God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now let us go, we plead to you, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our Elohim. But I know that the sovereign of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give you this people favor, and I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall come to pass that when each of you go, each of you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver, gold, jewelry, and for clothing. And you shall put on your sons and on your daughters, so shall you plunder the Egyptians." Now it's interesting. One of the things God does here is he begins to modify what he had told Moses he would do. He now begins to add a lot of specifics. Some of the specifics he adds is that Egypt is going to resist, right? And because they're going to resist, he's going to do some mighty works that will culminate in Egypt relinquishing and letting Israel go. He also tells them that they're to plunder the Egyptians. They're going to ask of the Egyptians for clothing and jewelry and so on. So and by doing so, they're going to take a lot of the Egyptian wealth out with them. That idea of plunder is interesting as well. That idea there means to not go out empty, and it usually is translated as rescue or deliver. In most cases it's used. So it would be, for instance, so you shall be rescued of the Egyptians. It could also have a variation where it could be translated, so shall you rescue the Egyptians. It could be rendered that way as well. And it's open-ended. And the reason it's open-ended is it all depends what is going to befall Egypt on how they respond. And it could go one of a couple of different ways for them. So the whole point, though, is that Israel has been serving Egypt for a long period of time, and God looks at it and he says, they're due wages. And you're going to get your wages this way. And that's how they're going to receive their monetary wage, so to speak. But God has already begun to adapt his plan. Moses is first rejection was, I'm inadequate, who am I to go? His second rejection was, well, give me your name so I can have power over you. Little did he expect that God would give him his name and get into this long discussion with him about things he would do. Then the third thing he brings up is in chapter 4, verse 1. If somebody would like to read that.
Moses answered and said, but, behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, the Lord has not appeared unto you.
Okay, so Moses' response is this, his third argument. What if you're wrong and they don't believe me? You ever think sometimes that you were coming with some news to tell somebody and you didn't think that the person that you were telling it to would believe you? Never happened, right? And there's always that doubt in the back of your mind, well, should I even tell them this? Because if they don't believe me, I'm going to feel like a real idiot. That's how, that was Moses' excuse. Well, what if they don't believe me that you sent me? What if they really think I'm just giving them a lie? And God is dealing very patiently with Moses here, and he responds in verses 2 through 9. And his response is he's going to give three different signs. It's interesting. If you go to verse 9, for instance, somebody would like to read that.
If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on a dry ground.
It's interesting because God gives three different signs so that they would believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first sign that he gives is where he takes the rod, right, throws it on the ground and it becomes a serpent. Then he puts his hand into his tunic or cloak and brings it out and it's leprous. Then he puts it back in and it's the way it would be normally. And then the last sign is that he would turn the water into, the river would become blood. So he gives three things Moses could do so that they would believe him. And it's interesting also with these signs. Look for a second if you go back to verse 18 of chapter 3. Somebody want to read that again? Just the first phrase.
And they will listen to your voice.
They will listen to your voice is what he says in chapter 3. Notice the adjustment here in chapter 4, verse 9. If they will not believe. It goes from a point of they will believe, no and, ifs, or buts, to, well, if they don't believe. I'm willing to concede to you, Moses, that maybe there's going to be some doubt there. So I'm going to answer that doubt by giving you these signs. God, again, is looking at it and he's saying, okay, there's the possibility, that even though it's really remote, that maybe it would go the way that Moses is saying. So we'll adjust it a little bit more. I'll get more specific. I'll give you overwhelming evidence that I'm with you. This still isn't good enough for Moses, though. And Moses comes in with the fourth one in verse 10. But Moses said to Adonai, or to the Lord, or to the master, you could translate it that way too, O my Elohim or God, I am not eloquent. Either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. In other words, I'm a really poor speaker, Lord. You don't want me to go. I'll be honest. This was one of the things I always struggled with. Whenever I would get up and speak in front of people, I always would hear every little mispronunciation or, the usage of maybe a wrong tense when you listen back to what you had to say. And that was something I would look at and get hung up with myself. But a lot of us think that way. We're inadequate. We're not good enough speakers. A lot of kids have that fear when they stand up in a classroom. And when they stand up in a classroom and they're giving that oral book report, the dreaded oral book report. And it ties knots in their stomach because they look at it and they say, I'm a poor speaker and I'm not the one you should send. And Moses is saying, well, you know, Lord, there's a lot better guys than me on speaking. Interestingly enough, if I was to use American history, a person who used to be ridiculed for his speech was Abraham Lincoln. He actually had a very high, squeaky voice. Not what we picture. We always get this idea of this guy because he's so tall, having this deep voice that was just this picture-perfect tone. In fact, he was quite the opposite. It was a high-grating kind of a voice on people, and he would be ridiculed about it all the time.
Never heard that.
It's true. And oftentimes he viewed it, well, what I have to say is more important than the fact that they're going to poke fun at me and ridicule me. But he was really ridiculed because he had a voice kind of like this. And it just was a grating voice. There's old newspaper clippings that you can get from the 1800s where they would poke fun of Lincoln's voice in his speech. And yet when we read his speeches, we come away thinking, wow, this is magnificent. This is a masterpiece. But they didn't think it back then because of that. So a lot of great people in history have had what we would look at as an inadequate speaking voice. But God doesn't let them off the hook even with that. God adjusts the plan again. And the way he adjusts it is in verse 11. And here, God responds back and he says, and Yahweh, or the Lord, said to him, who made man's mouth? Or who makes the dumb, or the deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Is it not I, Yahweh? And now go, and I will be with your mouth, and will direct you what you shall speak. So here's God's answer. Don't have to worry about it, Moses, because I'll give you the words to say. I'll be with your mouth, and anything that comes out of your mouth, because I put those words there, and it will be my words coming out of your voice. What do you think would it be like having God put his words into their mouth so that it would be a nice thing, wouldn't it? You wouldn't have to worry about what to say because everything would be said in a perfect way, right? I mean, this is a pretty good deal for Moses if he takes God up on that. You know, the idea is, well, Moses may be a poor speaker, but I'm not letting you off this easy. I will be with you. I will be with your mouth, and it will be me speaking through you. Moses comes up with a fifth reason not to go. And his fifth reason we find here in verse 13. Somebody would like to read that. I'll read it here too because it says it in really easy, plain language. But he said, oh my Adonai, or Lord, please send someone else. The idea is, I don't want to go. I have no more excuses. I just don't want to go.
But I don't want to go.
That's even said better,
Andy.
I don't want to go.
I don't want to go.
It's really, the idea, though, is I really do not want to go. Oftentimes in life, we end up having to do things we don't want to do. Usually it's because we have no alternative. You know, every other avenue of how to get out of it has been exhausted and we're stuck having to do something we don't want to do. And Moses is looking at this and he's had this debate with God now that's been running through one entire chapter of the book of Exodus and now is into the second chapter. And stop and think about that for a second. God has devoted two entire chapters to this dialogue between himself and Moses. Do you think maybe that what God is trying to convey is important? That maybe he's letting us know how a relationship with him works and the dynamic of it, that it's not stagnant, that we can have a give and take, that we can voice our concerns, and God will come back and maybe look at it and say, okay, you have a valid concern, and I can adjust some things. And as he adjusts things, then that creates other concerns, which then it creates more adjustment. In other words, God isn't static, and God isn't fatalistic. For instance, there's two ways we could view Scripture. The one way is everything is etched in stone, and everything works out the way God wants it to work out. In other words, we really have no choices because God decreed this, and it's going to happen because God decreed it. We'd all be robotic in that sense. We have very little choice in anything. We do things that we do because, well, I was made this way. Or we do things that we do because, well, that must have been God's will. I've heard that people say that whenever something bad befalls them. Well, God must have a plan in that. Maybe God didn't have a plan in that. Maybe it happened because it happened. And maybe God just wants to have a dialogue with you about it, and it could alleviate it. But the point is, most of us have that fatalistic approach, and when we have that fatalistic approach, we kind of throw up the hands and say, well, what's the use? How many people, when they pray to God, honestly and really truly believe that God is willing to listen to what they have to say and to adjust what he's going to do for them? How many people really believe that? And if they don't believe that, then why are they praying? Think about that. Isn't prayer predicated on the idea that God responds to you? Isn't prayer predicated on the idea that God is adaptable and that things that are befalling you don't necessarily have to continue to befall you? Isn't God a God who is willing to look at it? Sometimes you can't get out of a situation. But doesn't God also promise you that in that situation, his grace would be there to cover you in it?
He just doesn't want you to be anxious.
He doesn't want you to be anxious. He wants you to have that peace that can pass all understanding. He wants you in any situation to really have a calmness about you.
But not be fatalistic.
Well, not be fatalistic. Because there's always the ability that the plan or what's befallen you can be changed.
Right. And the opposite of the anxiety is faith. So if you ask God to take care of something and then you act on your own strength as if God isn't going to do what you asked him to do, then you lack the faith.
A prime example of that in Scripture. Everybody remembered a time when the Lord was walking on the water in the midst of the storm, and Peter asks the Lord, well, can I come out there with you? Comes out of the boat, and he's walking on the water, just like Jesus, right? Until he looks around him, and he sees all the wind howling and the waves and the storm, and then he starts to sink. And the Lord reaches out and saves him, pulls him back into the boat, and what does he tell Peter? Oh, you of little faith. Right? In other words, as long as his eyes were fixed on God and his relationship with God, he was able to do things he never thought he could do. The minute he took his eyes off of that, he began to sink. Yeah, a lot of those passages come in. Another interesting thing when you think about this also is how patient God's been in all of this with Moses.
Yeah,
I mean,
two chapters worth
of frivolous, I don't want to do this.
Bantering.
And the whole point God's wanting to get at is that, Moses, you're going to go. It's almost like if I was dealing with Ulrich and he doesn't want to do something, well, ultimately I'm going to win, right? Now, he has a choice. He's either going to do it the easy way or the hard way. Or maybe some things are negotiable. In this case, some things happen. One of the things that's negotiable is, well, Moses was going alone originally. Now Aaron's going with him. Well, we'll be going with him. We haven't gotten to that yet. One of the things we saw is that the plan became adaptable in that they would take wealth out of Egypt with them. One of the things we saw that God added into it is that he would allow Moses to perform certain miracles. None of that was mentioned in the beginning. It was all in reference to things that Moses brought up on why he shouldn't go. And God added things to it to make it more likely so that Moses would go. So he gives a response here to Moses after Moses says, I don't want to go. In verse 14, then Yahweh, or the Lord, became angry with Moses. That word angry, by the way, literally means to burn with anger, is the idea. We could look at the idea of maybe it could be translated, then Yahweh, or the Lord, began to burn with Moses, would be a way you could render that as well. And he said, what about your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he can speak very well. Moreover, he is coming to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. So you are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and as for me, I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you both what you must do. He will speak for you to the people, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were his God or Elohim. And you shall take this rod in your hand by which you shall do signs. Now follow this. After all that, Moses says, well, I don't want to go. And God says, you're going, Moses. And as you go, Aaron's going to speak for you. I'm going to put my words into your mouth, Moses. You're going to give your words to Aaron. Then I will be with Aaron's mouth so that my words come out the way I intend them to come out to Pharaoh's king. And you will be to Moses as I am to you. Or you will be to Aaron as I am to you. Mm-hmm. The whole point here is that this had been an open dialogue, and then Moses runs out of excuses, and he ends up relenting in verse 18. Moses went and returned to his father-in-law Jethro and said to him, please let me go and return to my brothers who are in Egypt and see whether they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. In other words, God took away every argument. But by taking away every argument, it meant that God had to adjust certain things. He had to change certain things. He added certain things into the equation that wasn't there originally. In other words, the plan was this, and it became this. In all through scriptures, we read of that everywhere. And the reason for it, and again, that's the mistaken notion that a lot of people have, we always get this idea that the future is fixed. We get the idea that God is outside of time, that he knows everything that ever did happen, everything that will happen, and everything that's going to happen, and everything that is happening. He knows all of those three things. Well, two of those are correct. He knows everything that's knowable. What's knowable? Well, the past, right? And the present. But the future hasn't happened, has it? So if the future hasn't happened, can anyone know it? The answer is no. And what you have here is God is willing to put himself at risk. That's a good term. There's a book that was written by a guy by the name of John Saunders. Probably the best book on this topic ever written. And it's called The God Who Risks. It's really good. And what he lays out, and I believe he's right, is that God could have done everything where he made everything robotic. He could have made Adam where Adam could never have disobeyed. But he didn't. He wanted to have a relationship with people, and part of having a relationship with people means that people can think for themselves. And if people can think for themselves, it means that maybe they might not do what I want them to do. Maybe it means that I have to become adaptable to interact with them. And for instance, you see God interacting all the time. Remember when Abraham offered Isaac on the altar? And what's said there is, now I know that you will not withhold. Well, here's the question. If God is saying, now I know that you will not withhold thy son, Isaac, did he not know beforehand? And the answer is, if we're to take words literally, that's exactly what it means. He's waiting for Abraham to respond to him. But by doing that, God makes himself, he opens himself up to a certain degree of vulnerability. He opens himself up to where he can be second-guessed. He opens himself up to where he can be despised and hated. He opens himself up to people who can do all sorts of ridiculous things. And it means that he has to become flexible and adaptable in order to have a relationship. Because people change. People don't stay stagnant. And God, by doing that, guarantees that he's a God who can be there for you. For instance, and I believe this is all in his adaptability plan, if he had made everybody a robot, where everybody would have done exactly what he wants them to do, would sin have ever entered the equation?
No.
No. And if sin never entered the equation, would his son ever have had to come here and die? No. Did God make himself vulnerable by allowing that?
Well, to a degree.
To a degree. I mean, for instance,
he already had planned for the outcome. But
he planned for the possibility that it would happen. So when I say vulnerable, I don't mean vulnerable like a person.
Like we would think. Yeah.
Right. It means that he's made it so that it takes some work on his end to have a relationship with us. And I think that's the whole key. He values us so much that he's willing to work at it to have that relationship with us. When we get to this part in Exodus, the golden calf, remember that rebellion when they make the golden calf? And they're all bowing down and worshiping it, and he sends Moses down from the mountain, and God's really angry, and he says, I'm gonna destroy this people and start a nation, and I'll do it with you, Moses. That way he could still keep his promise with Abraham. I'll make a nation of your descendants, right? Because Moses is a descendant from Abraham. But he get rid of everybody else. And what does Moses do?
Argues with him.
He argues with him to what end? What's Moses want?
You can't do that. Well, what will the people of the surrounding nations say? He brought them out into the wilderness to kill them all,
right?
Just like they said.
Right. So God relents, right? God changes his mind.
Yeah.
But what is, does God change some things with Moses at that point? Remember what he tells him he's going to do? He's going to send an angel to go before them, and he's not going to do it anymore?
Yeah, right.
Right?
Moses argues with him about that, too.
Moses, and God's not going to relent, and then all the people go into mourning because of that, and then God sees it, and he changes his mind. That's the idea I'm getting at. And then Moses asks God, well, can I see your glory? And God gets into that discussion. It was interesting when Rick talked about that the other day. But part of the reason, if you think about it, is this was a point when God was really just going to wipe out Israel, and he wasn't going to listen to Moses. It wasn't until all the people really repented and began to go into mourning that God said, okay, will do this. But he does give another law later on that's more harsh, right? But I believe at that point, Moses is asking God to see his glory because he wants to get to know God even better. And by knowing so, he can know what the parameters are and what he can discuss with God and what's of no use to discuss with him. And what's the first thing God says when he refers to his glory? What's the first thing he identifies with himself?
No man can see me and live.
Well, he says that, but what attribute is the first one he brings up?
Good? Merciful.
Yeah, he's merciful. If you go to chapter 34... child that you've told to pick up the room and they're giving you all the reasons, and you're willing to barter with them and give them that, and you're willing to dialogue with them until they come to the point of, well, I'm not doing it. Then he got angry. But he had Moses brought up other things that he was concerned about. I'm going to guess that God probably would have addressed those just from the way the dialogue had went. I think when we understand all of that and we look at it, it tells us that God is a God who's willing to listen to us, he's willing to work with us, and we have a lot of leeway with him. He's not some vindictive God willing to zap us every time we get out of line. He's a God that's willing to meet our concerns and to address them, and to give us comfort in those things. So next week, what we'll get into is we'll really look at what it means when it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. I want to address that. Because it doesn't mean what it's typically taught to me. It's not what we think. So if we could actually read through during the week the account of Moses before Pharaoh, if you could read from, say, chapter 5 up through chapter 12. Any questions?
The interesting thing with that is that everybody always forgets.
Everybody but Jonah.
Everybody always forgets this. Jonah, at the end in chapter 4 of the book, the very end of it, he goes, well, this is why I didn't do it, because I knew you would change your mind. The whole point is Jonah understood that God would relent when people responded to him. That it wasn't etched in stone.
Mm-hmm.
That there was the possibility that God wouldn't destroy the Ninevites. And that made Jonah angry because the Ninevites were enemies of his people Israel. And Jonah didn't like that. And the fact that God was willing to relent on their destruction made Jonah angry. In fact, it's weird. It's the only book in the entire Bible where it will end with a question that's not answered. Because the last phrase of the book is a question, and it doesn't answer it. I think there's reasons why he doesn't answer it. Kind of neat little book.
I don't think Jonah can handle the answer.
But he didn't want a dialogue, he ran away.
He ran away. Yep. And it's kind of cool because it shows two interesting points. There are some things that God's not going to be flexible about. There are some things that will take place. For instance, you will end up in Nineveh, Jonah. One way or another, you're going there. But there's some flexibility in things, too. The Ninevites don't necessarily have to be destroyed. You know, they might be, depending on what they do.
Eventually, they're going to get destroyed.
He could have said to them, you're going to preach, and they're going to be led. And Jonah didn't want no part of it. He just had such a hard heart toward the whole disparity. I'm out of here.
He even tried to kill himself
rather
than go. And he said, even later in the book, he wishes he was dead after the gourd dries up.
Doubtless he was in an awful lot of pain.
Yeah.
He wanted some blood.
Well, do you recall why he didn't want to do that? Because God was going to use Assyrians to
scourge Israel.
To punish Israel.
Yeah. So he's looking at it as a way to get rid of them before that ever takes place.
Yeah.
But that thinking there also shows that in Jonah's mind the future isn't necessarily set. Because if the Ninevites can get destroyed,
then that prophecy wouldn't
take place.
They couldn't punish Israel.
You know, you'd get somebody else.
Oh.
The Babylonians, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. But the whole thing is
kind of worked out.
Book.
Well, a part of the Assyrians took
the north.
Israel.
Yeah.
Babylonians
idea. Mm-hmm. Then after that, we'll probably go through some of the
plagues.
The plagues themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Any questions? Any comments from Ohio?
The only thing I was thinking about is when you mentioned Sanders' book, The God Who Risks.
Right.
The only thing with that is, I think it's like John said, it's to a certain extent, because Sanders, if I understood his book correctly, he didn't see that eventually all are going to be reconciled to God. So
no.
God has declared that from the beginning. So I know it's kind of like a relative thing, isn't it? When we say God was taking a risk.
Right. Well, it's a limit. When I say risk, I don't mean, for instance, there are certain things that are etched in stone that God's going to have happen. By risk, I mean that he's taking the risk that people will take a long time to develop a relationship with him. That relationship sometimes isn't going to be smooth or flow in a good way. We could say
that in the short term, his plan can be repudiated, but eventually, it will be fulfilled.
That's correct.
Yeah,
good way to phrase it.
And that's why one of the attributes of God is slow to anger comes
right.
in.
Right.
Very fits in very well with that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It does.
Very good, guys. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
A lot of good comments about the conference, Ted. And your
It was. It was really. They always are special in one way or another, aren't they? They're just every time we get together, it's a real joyful time. I wish more could have been there from our group here, but it was really. And I wish the Richmond gang would have come up. They ended up not coming. I thought for sure they were going to be there. But they all missed out. But like you guys said, they can get it on the CDs there. So. Oh, you're all gone.